Preparations.
"You speak Hindi?" asked the elder security man. Jordan nodded, bringing a frown to the makeup woman's round face. "A little," he answered. "Enough to get along." And he remembered the war in Kashmir. The war I was supposed to stop. The war that killed Miriam. The memory of his wife's death brought a stab of pain, but it was muted, softened, almost as if it had happened to someone else in another life. Still, the pain lurked there. The makeup woman complained, "You've got to keep still, otherwise you'll smear the color." "Sorry," Jordan said, properly sheepish. He was sitting in the barber's chair in the Otero building's makeup room. The other two chairs were empty, and the only people in the room besides Jordan and the makeup woman were a trio of unicorn agents. More security people were out in the corridor, guarding the door. As far as the general public was concerned, Jordan Kell had been seriously injured by the assassination attempt and was being whisked to a private medical facility under heavy guard. Actually, he had never left the Otero building. The heavy-set woman stepped back to survey her handiwork. Jordan looked into the mirror and saw that his face was now as dark as a native Gujarati's, and his silver hair had been transformed into deep black. His cheekbones had been sharpened, made more angular. The elder unicorn agent pulled a small black box from his jacket pocket, saying, "These contact lenses will show the proper retinal patterns to the scanners when you go through customs on Gandhi. The machines will think you're Lakshmi Ramachandran, a unicorn employee who's vacationing at the habitat." "He's a security man?" The agent made a sour face. "He's an accountant, a bean counter." Looking at the image of the real Ramachandran on the view screen set up on the shelf beneath the wall mirror, Jordan muttered, "I hope you don't have to break my nose." "Nope," said the makeup woman. "Just a little prosthesis and you'll look just as ugly as he is." Gilda Nordquist was not accustomed to being stonewalled. "Surely you could at least tell me where Mr. Kell has been taken," she said to the image on her phone screen. The flinty-eyed unicorn executive replied evenly, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but we feel it's necessary to keep Mr. Kell under wraps for the time being." "But I represent the World Council," Nordquist reminded him, trying to keep the frustration from showing in her face or her tone. "We can demand that you reveal his whereabouts." The man hiked his thin brows a little. "I suppose you could ask Mr. Otero himself, or maybe go to the International Court of Justice, and
that would take days, perhaps even weeks."
"For what it's worth," the man said, "Mr. Kell has agreed to our arrangements." A trace of a smile curled the corners of his mouth. "Apparently he doesn't want you people to put him in protective custody."
"But he agreed to come to our facility on the space habitat, to be with his wife."
The man shook his head. "He's not going anywhere. Not for a while, at least." Nordquist abruptly cut the connection, thinking, "Now I'll have to get a team to ferret out Kell's location. And what then? Can the Americans keep him out of our hands? I'll have to ask the legal department about that." And, she knew, she'd have to tell Anita Halleck about this latest kink in the road. Too bad the assassin didn't kill the troublesome son of a bitch. In the headquarters of the Boston Police Department, local and federal police detectives crowded the three interrogation rooms where the would-be assassin and his two female companions had been taken. A trio of World Council security agents were also there, one in each room. Nick Matrenko still looked woozy from the paralysis charge that Cree had fired into his neck. A matronly Boston Police Department nurse brandished a hypospray syringe, while one of the detectives rolled up Matrenko's sleeve.
"What's that?" Matrenko mumbled.
"Just something to wake you up," said the detective.
"It won't hurt a bit," the nurse reassured him.
Matrenko flinched when the cold metal touched his skin, but once the stimulant hissed into his bloodstream, he perked up. His eyes focused on the men and women around him.
"Did I get him?"
"Clean miss," said one of the detectives. "You're a lousy shot, kid." "I never fired a gun before," Matrenko admitted. "You blasted the lectern pretty good, but I didn't kill him."
"Why'd you want to kill him?"
Matrenko looked up at them with disbelief.
"Why? He's a traitor. He's selling us out to the aliens."
The World Council agent leaned in between a pair of Boston detectives and asked stonily, "What makes you think that?" Within half an hour, they got Nick's story of Jordan Kell's selling out the human race and the impending alien takeover. Batranko earnestly pleaded with them to do something about the coming alien invasion. It wasn't until he realized that they all thought he was slightly daft that he thought to claim his rights and demand a lawyer. By nightfall, Jordan and three Unicorn agents, including Hamilton Cree, were at Logan Aero Spaceport, lining up to board the rocket shuttle that would take them to Habitat Gandhi. They were all traveling as tourists. Jordan saw that Cree was several places ahead of him in line. The other two agents were behind him. The Unicorn men were all in casual clothes, colorful short-sleeved shirts and trim dark slacks. Jordan was dressed as a Gujarati working man in a hip-length white tunic and slightly baggy tan slacks. He placed his travel visa on the electronic scanner's plate, then stood before the optical scanner that registered his retinal pattern. Despite himself, he held his breath. The machine beeped and flashed a green light. Suppressing a grin, Jordan headed down the access tube that led to the shuttle's main hatch. It was an overnight flight that accelerated at slightly less than 1G halfway to its destination, then decelerated to a 0G rendezvous with the gigantic habitat. Before liftoff, the passengers had to watch a safety video that emphasized they would experience weightlessness near zero gravity only for the few minutes of turnaround and during the final approach to the habitat's airlock. The shuttle lifted off with a shuddering roar that pressed Jordan deep into his cushioned seat. The video screen built into the seat back in front of him showed the Earth falling away. The sky turned from blue to black, and in a few minutes the vibrations smoothed out, and he felt comfortable again. "We're on course and on time," came the captain's reassuring voice. "Next stop, Habitat Gandhi." Most of the passengers cranked their seats back and tried to sleep. The woman next to him slipped a blindfold over her eyes, Jordan saw. He tilted his seat back and slid a set of smart glasses over his eyes. The frames included tiny speakers that he could hear through bone conduction. To the travelers around him, Jordan seemed to be drowsing off. But actually, he was waiting for Aditi to call him.